Welcome to the Explore Worlds, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Matthew Robison, Danir Aked and Chair Akhil Ahmed discuss the ethics of documenting and reporting humanitarian crisis zones, exploring the fine line that journalists and filmmakers have to tread between help and harm. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, we discuss the challenges of avoiding misery porn and ensuring ethical, impactful storytelling while safeguarding those involved.
Hello, and welcome to this lovely session we're going to have, looking at a discussion around the ethics of documenting and reporting humanitarian crises and working in war zones and crisis zones. My name's Akhil Ahmed. I'm going to be chairing this for you today. I am the former head of religion and ethics at the BBC and at Channel 4. And I know Matt, who I'll be introducing in a minute, but I also have worked in many, many war zones and crisis zones, unfortunately, in my time, and was once, for 5 years actually, was a trustee of Muslim Aid. So I've also had to work with regards to getting people to donate to charities in when you've been particularly in crisis situations. So with us for this conversation is, to my right, is Matthew Robison. Now, Matthew has been working in TV for, well, it says here 25 years, but I'm sure it's a lot longer than that. But he's also been working for a long time as well in the charity sector. His book, 104 In the Shade, which is Travels of a Humanitarian Filmmaker, details his experiences as a filmmaker in some of the world's most hostile environments. And next to Matthew, we have Danir Aked. And Danir is the Middle East Eye Senior Investigative Editor. And in 2022, her reporting on women's rights in the Middle East was recognised with a Right to End Violence Against Women's Features of the Year Award and was shortlisted at Drums Awards Journalist of the Year. You can find out more as well if you go onto the website and look at their biographies in more detail. But I'm going to kick off, actually, with you, Matthew, just to start off and say, tell us a little bit about your book.
Okay.
You know, because that's what started the desire to have this conversation in the first place.
Indeed. Okay, well, salam alaikum. Thank you, everyone, for coming, firstly. Thanks to Bradford Literature Fest. Thanks to you guys for being on the panel. I was in mainstream TV for 16 years, and then I'd had enough. I quit. I took a 75% pay cut to do something that I felt was worthwhile, because TV, just the money was good, but it kind of soul-destroying. And the content didn't really align with my beliefs, you know. So I joined Muntada Aid, which is a charity above West London Islamic Cultural Centre. And that was the start of my journey, you know, from refugee camps to aid delivery in Yemen, in Somaliland, running marathons in Palestine. And on every trip I went on, I took a notepad and one of those propelling pencils. And I was so busy, I never managed to put pen to paper, not once. So it was February 2021, second lockdown, I believe. And I was like, what can I do? There was no work, nothing going on. So I started writing. I felt that my experiences, I wanted to try to share my experiences in some way, try and inspire other people to do more charity work, or, you know, just open their eyes to what's going on around the world. You know, maybe some of my family members were in my mind when I wrote this, because obviously, you know, I'm a Muslim reaver, and they're English, and so they weren't particularly aware of everything that I was doing. So, you know, with that in mind, so I started writing, and after 4 weeks, it was like, you know, run, Forrest, run. It was right, Matt, right. I just didn't stop. 42,000 words, and then a poor Farah, my wife, I'd be like, one in the morning, look, what do you think about this? And I'd read a passage from it. But yeah, 18 months, 6 drafts later, then the book was written. So,
and it obviously documents a lot of the work that you've done as well.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
And Danir, obviously your work with Middle East and I is not, tell us, explain a little bit about that and how that relates to the subject.
So first of all, thank you for coming. Really excited to talk about this. I do both reporting and editing for Middle East Eye. My reporting is sort of long-form investigative work, and this year has been a lot about Gaza, and often about UK foreign policy as it relates to Gaza, but also about conditions on the ground that I can get, you know, secondhand. So I was at a desk. I wasn't in Gaza, obviously. But at Middle East Eye, I'm really proud. Something that's really special about us, I think, is that most of our correspondents, people reporting on these crisis zones or wars, are in country, are from the country, and are reporting from there. So we have a reporter in Gaza, Maha Husseini, and we have a photographer there. And so my role is to edit the pieces that come in and to discuss sort of the angles that are being covered, but they're really driven by the people who are in the field and on the ground and have the local context. I'm really proud of that, and that's kind of my role at Middle East Eye, sort of working with the team in London to take the reporting from the ground and put it out onto our website.
And how important is it that you have, I mean, obviously the reality is that nobody can get into Gaza anyway, but how important is it to you that you have those local voices, and what difference are they making in terms of the storytelling?
Yeah, no, incredibly important. I mean, first of all, they're being guided by our Jerusalem bureau chief, Lubna, who's in Jerusalem. I mean, when the 7th of October kicked off, our news meetings weren't just planning meetings. They were very emotional meetings where we were getting sort of reports from Lubna on everything she was watching and feeling at that moment. So it wasn't just telling the news. It was like sort of experiencing it with people who were in the country. And I really think that changed the way we were thinking about it in London. But then in terms of having our correspondents in Gaza, I think it's incredibly important because not only are we getting, you know, the actual stories of people on the ground in the moment at the time. I mean, for example, often we'll hear something like, people will be told to move somewhere and it's safe, and then Israel will bomb, you know, quickly at some point. And Maha's right there, you know, Israel's been bombing, and she goes and she gets the coverage. And so that's really important in itself. We're getting facts and color that other outlets won't be getting. But also, Maha and Mohammed Hajar, our photographer, are living through this. And so we're hearing from them, you know, what it's like for them to just cover it. They've been displaced over and over and over again, and they're still reporting. So I think that's also really important to keep that in mind as we're working with them on it, because we sort of get a better sense of the context. And
it's a complicated picture, I know, because and it's a complicated picture because I know that obviously people can't just leave anyway, right? But you, at some point, I must imagine, have a duty of care. And how do you balance that with this desire to be able to kind of get the coverage, which you hope would influence this and actually inform and educate the population or around the world who are looking at Middle East and I to understand actually what's going on in Gaza?
Yeah, I definitely think there have been moments when Maha and Mohammed have needed a break, maybe because emotionally the toll was just too much, but also things have happened to them. Mohammed was, I think, held at the border between northern Gaza and southern Gaza at some point and had his money taken. And obviously at those moments, we stop. They don't need to work. We're not sort of forcing them to do work they don't want to do. It's almost, they're very compelled to keep going, right? So there is a duty of care. And when things get too much, there's a pause. Even for Lubna, the Jerusalem bureau chief, there sometimes needs to be a pause. It's very overwhelming, as I can see from them. I don't, you know, it's not, it is overwhelming for me as well, but in a totally different way. So we do have a duty of care, and I think we do give rest periods, but also things are happening to them. For example, recently Maha was given an award by an organization in the U.S. for her courage. Yeah, it was a Women in Journalism Courage Award. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact organization now. But after she was awarded this, there was a big pro-Israeli campaign looking at two tweets she had done years ago and completely, I think, taking them out of context. And basically, this organization pulled her award as a result of it. So at that moment, we came out, you know, sort of really saying, hey, look at Maha's work. We honor her work. Her words by themselves that's the honor. The best way to honor Maha is by reading her words, forget this award kind of thing. So we try to support in that way too.
Yeah. And Matt, in terms of that duty of care, I'm just going to take it to another place now, which is obviously when you're in those kind of humanitarian areas where there's maybe a famine, war, natural disaster, whatever it may be, and you see somebody suffering, Now, we've had this conversation previously. As a documentary filmmaker, we carry on rolling, right? Carry on filming, I should say. What do you do?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I give an example. Chapter 8 in my book is about, it's called Rohingya. And it was, so chapter 6 is undercover. I went undercover filming in Myanmar prior to the genocide. And then 2 chapters later, it's post-genocide. And we obviously, the job of a humanitarian filmmaker is to, it's got this kind of 3 jobs, two main roles to it really. One is to show what's going on for donor purposes. So donor feedback, because obviously in the charity sector, donors need to see where their money's being spent. But also for the need. So people, you invoke emotion in people, people want to give. And that's pretty much the nature of the job. But we were in one of the Rohingya camps, I think it was Balokali camp, and we went into this hut and spoke to this mother, and she relayed to us. I've never cried, it's the only time I've ever cried in the field, because I don't agree. I think when you go into a situation, whatever your emotions are, you're there to serve them. Your feelings, take them home, deal with it afterwards at home. But this was something else. And I kept rolling. She was describing how her son was choked to death by these soldiers. And then how she showed scars on her head, and then her daughter showed scars on her. She showed scars on her daughter's head. And that's from stopping the soldiers gang raped her, basically, in front of this 6-year-old. All the rest of the family were killed, the husband, the 2 sons. And sitting in that moment, just witnessing someone's pain, I didn't know where the line was at that day. She wanted her story to go out. But then the hardest thing for me was, once I'd filmed that, a few hours later, in an air-conditioned minibus, drinking ice cold water on our way back to the hotel. Oh, we were going to stop off and have a dip in the Andaman, in the Bay of Bengal, you know, to cool down. It hit me like a ton of bricks that she was still there. And I was able to leave that situation. But, you know, as I wrote a poem about it, because it affected me so deeply, you know, and the final line is the poem, you know, where are they now? I don't know. They will always be their mother and daughter existing with the dead. Because, yeah, I just feel that in that example, in that case, she wanted us to keep filming. She wanted a story to go up. She said it was important. And obviously, when you go into these situations, you need to look at informed consent. Is someone doing this because they feel they're going to get more from the charity? There's a whole load of different aspects you need to take into consideration. Would they be telling their story if they weren't in this situation?
But I suppose that's the question I'm really getting at is, actually, do you cover something? When something happens, you may stop, right? Usually you would stop.
Yes.
And you would do some. You would maybe help them.
Yes.
Whereas a documentary filmmaker...
We'll keep rolling, yeah.
In a sense, does that stop you from really documenting it, really? Because you're actually, what you are then becoming is more of an advocate for the story rather than actually covering the story.
I think it's a case-by-case basis. It's such a fine line to get it right. And but I don't know if there's a clip. I don't know if they're going to play a clip of from my latest film.
If you can get to it. But,
But basically, we were in Sindh post the floods, about 5 weeks, 6 weeks after the floods in Pakistan. And we stopped. We were on our way to a distribution. So we'd been fundraising. We were filming, families lining up, you know. And as it says in the documentary, as the head of the charity said, you know, we can help a few hundred people, but there's another like 2-3 million that we can't help. And it's heartbreaking. So the point was, we were on our way to this distribution, and there was a woman stood by the side of the road with her 2 babies. And she had been living for 6 weeks in 2 sticks and a tarpaulin. And you've got these trucks thundering by and everything's underwater. And at that moment, you know, I said to the ground partner, because obviously as a charity, you have to work with a ground partner, because I don't speak Sindh, and I very, very poorly understand Urdu. So so he spoke to her, and I said, is it okay if we ask her questions? And he said, is it okay if they talk? And they were like, yeah, that's fine. So she just described the situation. But we gave her some money and said, thank you for your time, and we left. But the big impact was, because it was a fundraiser's trip. So people who'd raised the money had come along to witness, to spread the word when they got home, to raise more money, raise awareness, try and be of more help. It was the person I was with in that rickshaw who was deeply affected by it. And, you know, so in that situation, that was different to the Rohingya situation.
What are you more comfortable with? Are you more comfortable with doing that kind of interjection? So you're not just documenting something. You would stop, you would help, you would do whatever, or actually being, say, more of an objective kind of person who's not necessarily going in there with, in that way, but you're just basically making a film. Which one works better?
First, I mean, I think, you know, in February, Farrell and I started a charity called Migration Relief, still with the Charity Commission. But basically, I went to Shatila Camp, and I went to Arsala Camp in Lebanon. And so I filmed, when I did these distributions, I also filmed, I did some interviews and I filmed for my own documentary. So I was kind of combining the two, but I still don't feel comfortable enough to keep rolling if something really serious was going down, or, you know.
I can see. How does that make, how do you feel about that?
Well, I haven't been quite in similar, but an ethical situation. I'm shaking my head because I was in a situation a year ago or so that was. I cover a lot of about Gulf women fleeing their own countries to get out of guardianship laws, get away from guardianship laws, get away from abusive families. And there were five sisters who had fled Kuwait, and they were in Istanbul. And I was getting messages from all the activists saying, cover them, they're in danger, you've got to cover this. Their family has come to Turkey, they're going to take them back. The Kuwaiti officials have come, they're going to take them back. And I thought, oh my gosh, we've got to do a story, we've got to help. So I interviewed one of the sisters, the oldest sister, and we got the whole story out, and I was starting to write it. And then I think it was maybe, I can't remember if it was a human rights lawyer or somebody I was interviewing also for the story said, wait a minute, you're going to make the situation a lot worse if you do this story. Because if you publicize something about how they're trying to flee to a third country, and that goes out and that's public, and then they go to, say, an airport, and they try to get in to say, you know, say they're coming to London, they're at Heathrow, and maybe a border guard looks and finds their name in a story and realizes kind of what they're doing and it's a little shady or whatever, that's not going to help them. So we had to kind of dial it back, and I had to have a conversation with the sisters, and I said, I'm really sorry. You've told me your story. It's crazy. I know that you're stuck in a bad situation, but I had to explain to them what I had been told. And I said, and it was awkward too, because I thought, how dare I tell you what's best for you in this situation? I haven't been through what you've been through. But ethically, I didn't feel that I could tell that story and do no harm. I was going to do more harm than good. And luckily, one of the sisters that decided to carry on got to the UK, and now we can do a story about what she experienced, right? But it's hard, and I think when I've been in those situations, we have to think about the people that we're reporting on first and foremost.
I mean, I'll give another example. When my first trip to the Horn of Africa, to Somaliland, the charity I was with, the brother was like, okay. And this was during the drought and the famine, 2017. And so we delivered a truck of water out into the desert, into this concrete pit, filled it up with water. And then as the water was coming out of the pump, the guy was like, okay, film this. And he filled his hands with water. And he said to a child, come and drink this. And I'm like, what? I'm not filming that. What are you doing? And he's like, well, in my community, this will be seen as a blessing. This will be seen. And I was just like, I'm not doing it. You made me do it. He made me do it. He pulled rank and said, you've got to do it. So I had to film it.
Sorry, I once managed him. I couldn't get you to do anything, quite frankly. So I must meet this guy, get his number.
He came round for a cup of tea. I thought, who is this Akil guy?
Yeah. But I suppose that's something that you objected to because you felt like there was manipulation going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's key. I think when in humanitarian filmmaking, if you follow everything that you're told with every person that engages you in a contract, it's not always the right thing to do. So I think it's very important to have a... First and foremost, it's the dignity of the beneficiaries that needs to come before anything else. You know, and, you know, there's such a thing as informed consent, and we were talking about this earlier. It's like, you know, what... Are they doing this? Are they appearing on camera out of desperation because they think they will get what they need if they put themselves out there in a way that they would never do that normally? So that's a fine line to gauge that when you talk to people. And quite often you get ground partners who maybe like grab this person and they're like, so yeah, it's, I think it's, if you have the beneficiary in mind, first and foremost above anything else, that's key. And then everything else follows after that for humanitarian charity filmmaking anyway.
Now, in terms of, obviously, right now, people are watching the genocide going on in Gaza and the imagery it's been constant for many months now. And it's a very difficult thing to say, but obviously the imagery, after a while, people become numb, desensitized. And I suppose in terms of actually when you're trying to get people to actually understand a crisis, whether it's man-made or natural, and you're in that situation, Dania, how do you go about cutting through something like that? Because it's really difficult, right?
Yeah, no, and it depresses me sometimes because I realize that everyone's getting flooded with images and we're having to cut through and actually get to people and really explain why it matters. And I often find in that situation, the more specific a story you can get, the more details you can get, the more you can tell it with emotion and color, the more likely you're going to get through to people.
So it's storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what you were talking about as well, Mike. You're finding characters, it's storytelling. But I suppose the thing I'm trying to think now from the point of view of charity kind of filmmaking in particular, you know, there's a whole thing about, particularly with Islamic charities, right? And I'm speaking on, you know, from my time in Muslim Aid. We had a specific ethical policy, which is we would only spend people's money where they asked us to spend it. Yeah. Now, the problem with that is, if you're doing that now, 100% of the money is going to be going to Gaza, Palestine. I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing. I'm simply saying when you are a charity and you are for the whole world and for the UK for that matter. So we can't spend money on food banks and the homeless here. You can't spend money in the Horn of Africa. Can't spend money in Sudan or wherever it may be where you really want to spend money. So how do you go about trying to cut through that kind of lack of knowledge in the communities that actually donate, and also the kind of like, I would say lack of, maybe just no interest.
Well, I mean, again, it's all down to who's running the charity.
No, but in terms of, if you think about the actual, we're in a perfect world, right? So everyone's behaving ethically.
Okay,
not those guys who, you know, God forbid the Charity Commission, you know, don't do enough, whatever. Yeah. But if you're in a situation where the money has to be, you know, you've got something so catastrophic as Gaza happening right now, yet at the same time, there are people, you know, the drought in the Horn of Africa is shocking, right? You've still got issues in the floods in Sindh, the impact of that. You've got all of those things going on, and we want to spend money there, right? If you're a charity, how do you go about cutting through what the reality that people want to spend money in Gaza right now? What do you have to do to actually get them to engage with other areas?
Okay, well, I believe, and this is what I've done with my film Salab, which hopefully we'll have a clip to play in a minute, take it outside of the echo chamber of the community. So if the community want to fund Gaza and Gaza alone, which is what is happening pretty much, maybe the Somali community will want to support Somaliland, Sudanese for Sudan. There's obviously crossover from everybody, but you have to appeal to a wider audience, I believe, because there also are many people that see Gaza as a faraway thing and aren't interested as well. Surprisingly, but true. So things like with Salab, the deal was with the charity. Obviously, I had a deal struck with them to make what they needed. Also, with my trips now, I fundraise because there is an element of guilt that I'm taking money for doing what I'm doing. So I kind of fundraise as well. But I agreed to make the content. But what I did with Salab was I said, okay, right, I'm going to make a documentary that I have full control over. I will show it to you out of courtesy for you to look at for any legal reasons, legal purposes. But then I'm going to put this into film festivals. And if it wins anything, I'll give you half the money and I keep half the money myself for my time, because this is all work that I do unpaid because it's off my own back. So now, I mean, this film has won best documentary feature in full festivals. One in Malaysia, Stockholm, Seville, Milan.
Oh, should we see a bit of it then? I think we have the... This is where it all goes wrong now, obviously. Technology.
This is what... You'll see the bit I was talking about just now as well with the beneficiary.
ॿारनि जे लाइ खाइण पीअण जो या को ॿियो अहिड़ो मसलो मसाइल आहे
I felt helpless. I was very emotional at the time because I knew I'm there only for a split second and I'm gone. For them, I could have been a sign of hope. I could have been a sign of change. And knowing that I'm driving on, you look in the mirror and they're slowly just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And then that's it, they're gone. And then that's it. You just think, is there something else I could have done? What more could I have done? Was my split second enough for them? Should I have given them more time? So much stuff goes through your head, and emotionally I just felt very low. I felt very weak. And I felt as if the world was crashing down. Imagine I left my sister like that. Will I be able to leave my sister like that?
So the whole point of this is it goes to film festivals, it takes it outside of the community, and hopefully that brings a greater exposure and greater knowledge and maybe interest to support that area, you know? Mm. So that's kind of...
Well, that's good. Obviously, you know, film festivals are great, right? Don't get me wrong. But
first time I've seen it on a big screen, so yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah, and as an editor, you probably see all the mistakes, don't you?
Sorry,
I was teasing you.
I did.
But it's great that going to film festivals is great. But in terms of actually cutting through with the people who are going to donate money, because who may not necessarily have that connection to a film festival, etc. Just generally as a subject, it's really hard, isn't it? It's really hard to actually get them to engage, because normally when you see videos that are made for charities, they're all very similar.
Well, yeah, I mean, generally they are. And I think that realistically, I think right now it's nigh impossible, because the barbarity, the absolute, I mean, I can't even, words don't cover it. What's going on in Gaza right now, it's unprecedented in our time to see what's unfolding live streamed onto our phones, onto our laptops. You're laid in bed, you wake up, first thing you see is a child with a flip-top head with nothing inside, you know? And I think that it's the reality is that it's so big that I can't see how anyone can cut through it unless, how any other appeal can cut through that unless it's people who from within that community. And that's a sad, sad reality of it.
But for you guys, though, you've got to cover other things, right? Because it can't just be wall to wall.
Yeah. And I've been thinking, one of the ways that we deal with this issue sometimes is by dialing it right back and doing very basic explainer stories. So what's happening in Sudan? How did that start? Or what happened at Nasser Hospital? Why is that important? You know, and just trying to dial it back a little bit, because I think, I don't know about you guys, but I, as a consumer, I feel part of the overwhelm sometimes is that I don't know everything about everything. And so I'm often kind of dipping in and I'm not really quite sure. So if you can kind of dial it back a little bit and just kind of go with people where they are, I think that can kind of help cut through a little bit. But then the person who's reading has to be interested enough to go looking for it, right? So it's a two-way street, but that's one way we try to deal with it.
Mm. I mean, do you manage to get much on in regards to Sudan?
Yeah, actually we do. We have quite a bit of coverage of Sudan. We have a Sudanese reporter. Unfortunately, he's had to leave. He's in Egypt now, but he has very good connections and helps us get color and stories from Sudan. I'm very proud of that. And also, one other thing that we do is, obviously, social media is very important. And we found that Instagram and TikTok, short videos, again, that explain very basic kind of things to kind of pull people in, is very helpful in that regard.
But it's a danger with some of this, though. It's a danger that basically when you're doing short videos, then the shorter and shorter it gets because you're worried about getting people's attention. So we're going to do a short video or TikTok, 30 seconds, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
That actually what you end up doing is it's just being fodder yourself.
Well, we try to connect people with like a next thing to read or a next thing to move on to. And again, it's on the person to go for it, right? But that's kind of the hope. We don't do it to just have it stop there. Our hope is it's a door. It's an open door.
That's like with the protest films I make. I cut the full thing, 10 minutes, and then I literally like put a 90-second reel out. Nobody watches the 10-minute one. Everyone watches the reel. But it gets a message across, but you're right. Depending which bit you choose, it can be hard hitting, but not all the information is there that people need to help make informed decisions with, as you say, for like donations and. Mm.
And in terms of the kind of work that you've been doing, Matt, wherever, obviously, you know, it's difficult, isn't it, working in countries like Myanmar, for instance?
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you go about actually making that work? Because I know when Muslim Aid went out there, because they were the first charity out there because they were already there. Mm. Had to change the name, so it wasn't Muslim Aid; it was MA, and all the men shaved the beards off before they went out.
Well, I went out with Team Orange, the local charity. So
yeah.
there was no Muslim reference there.
Yeah.
I did go out as a programs officer. So when we arrived at the edge of the Rohingya, we were followed everywhere we went by Secret Service, and when we got to the enclosure, and it was like a concentration camp, probably about 3 or 4 square kilometres, raised 30-foot high fences, razor wire. And they took our passports, took our photos, and I had my camera kit hidden under the seat. So that was a little bit hairy. I went and filmed stuff. And then when we left, they told me that they would go through my laptop, everything, memory cards. But they didn't. Amazingly, so we're sat on the runway, the plane's about to go, and then I see these blue lights coming across the runway, and I'm thinking, shit, that's it. It's going to be 6 years in a Myanmar jail.
If I'm lucky, yeah.
But no, it wasn't. So my imagination was running rings around me. So we took off, but then when I was talking about the Rohingya camps, when we went there the first time in the January of 2018, we were told by the Bangladeshi intelligence that myself, the presenter and the programs officer, the three of us who went, were on a list. So I can never go back to Myanmar. I don't want to go back to Myanmar. Don't know anyone would want to go to Myanmar, to be honest. Sorry if you're from Myanmar, but that's like from what I saw. I didn't like it, what was going on. And in my mind, I couldn't understand how Aung San Suu would do something like this. But then, as we've seen, that you know she's under house arrest again, isn't she? Or she's in prison now. So the thing was always run by the generals. But that wasn't the toughest thing for me. The toughest thing was Yemen. Mm. Now, when I arrived in 2018, it was April 2018, and the thing about Aden in Yemen, I didn't go to the front. But if you imagine like the Corleone family and the other ones, whoever they were in The Godfather, they hate each other. It's basically
the Italians.
It's basically East Aden, West Aden, and South Aden is a South Yemen separatist who are a bona fide political group. But these other ones, they're just gangs. So you had the Saudi-backed militia on one side, you had the Emirati-backed militia on the other. And so when we arrived, I was told that we'd have an armored personnel carrier, 8 soldiers, arrived, and they're like, where is everyone? He said, don't worry, we'll go to the hotel, we'll explain. So we got to the hotel, and they said, well, listen, we dispense with that, because if you go on an armored personnel carrier with a Saudi emblem on it, the Emirati lot are going to fire a rocket launcher at you and you're going to die. So I just ended up with a local scarf, a pair of sunglasses, sat between two people in a people carrier with tinted windows. And for me, at that time, the Saudis had just killed the deputy head of the Houthis. So they were expecting rocket attacks from Sana'a. Houthis had apparently infiltrated Aden, so they were expecting F-16s or F-14s to bomb certain areas of the city, and there were kidnappings, Al-Qaeda, ISIS were all there apparently. So I was in a panic thinking, I don't know what to do. And our escape route was $10,000 and a fishing boat kept at the port ready for us to jump in and head across to Djibouti if we needed to. And I was like, I thought I can't handle this, and I've got 6 days left. You know, what am I going to do? So the way I managed to deal with it was compartmentalize. So I remembered Eckhart Tolle, and he was a great help, great author, because I just thought about what am I doing now? And all I did was, I must have smoked about, I don't smoke anymore, but I'm smoking a cigarette, drinking coffee for the next hour. Nothing exists beyond that. And that's how I got through it, you know? And then when we took off after 5 days, I was grateful because on the way to the airport, it's a little bit of a giveaway from the book here, chapter 10. We went through the first checkpoint, and they put a permanent marker X on the driver's arm, got to the second checkpoint. And these checkpoints are about 30 meters apart. They're not far. They kind of go around like that. And bear in mind, there's blown up buildings, burnt out tanks, like everything's a mess. And all the soldiers there, their eyes are red. They're pranged out on cat, which is a local drug. So they're really jumpy. So that combined with AK-47s, rocket launchers, and that it is a little bit hairy. So we get to the third checkpoint, and they're just chatting. So they wave us through. As we're driving forward, one of the guy from the previous checkpoint screamed at these guys. So they jump up, and of course the two people driving, they're chatting away. We're driving forward, and I go, look over, and I'm like, can you stop? They carry on driving, and then I see the guy cocks his gun like that, goes like that. The other guy jumps up, pulls up a rocket launcher, and I screamed, stop! And we stopped. Now, before I went on this trip, one of the brothers in the studio said, are you nervous about going to a war zone? I was like, a little bit. He said, well, you've got nothing to worry about. I was like, why is that? He said, well, if you hear it but you don't feel it, you're fine. If you feel it and then you hear it, well, you survived because you heard it. And if you feel it and then there's nothing, you're going straight to Jannah, straight to heaven because of the work you're doing. You've got nothing to worry about. And that was what went through my mind.
That's not standard kind of like broadcasting health and safety.
And I was there. And that's the only time in my life I've accepted I was going to die in that moment. And I was there.
Is it worth it though, Matt? Is it worth you dying? I'm just going to say this now just because obviously, you know, is it worth you dying to cover a humanitarian crisis?
No, of course it's not.
But to cover the humanitarian crisis,
you put yourself at risk.
Yeah.
Well, that's
not all. I'm so glad you asked that, because that's what I've been wondering about.
Okay.
Well, would you sense, right, here's the thing. So I had to make decisions on whether people went to war zones and went myself as well, etc. Right.
Sorry, I was just going to say.
People? Yeah, go on then.
I was just going to say, obviously, they didn't fire the rocket launchers or the guns because I'm here today. But yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I think we all presume that.
I do assume.
Yeah, yeah. We all got to that one ourselves, but thank you. Just in case you didn't,
Just in case.
Yeah. But so the decision making to whether or not a subject like that is worth sending somebody to,
It's
quite a big deal, right?
Yeah. And for us, we're very small. I think the decision would often be, if the person is already in country and from that country, sure, of course, if it's safe. We often wouldn't send someone, we wouldn't parachute someone in with a real conflict zone. That's just because I think of our size. But I'm glad you asked the question, Matthew, because I've been wondering, you know, with all these stories, I'm like, but what's the risk calculation in your mind? You know, you've taken a lot of risks here.
I believe in something called the Qadr of Allah. So God's will. I believe that,
what's written is written.
What's written is written, and I think you take precautions and you do what you can. And I didn't intend to go to a war zone. That was just where I was sent. And that was my experience in that war zone. Mm. Subsequently, since then, I was told that I could get in with through the Saudi ministry via the Rafah crossing.
Mm.
That didn't happen. Then we were talking, my friend Faz. Do you know Faz?
Mind it.
Faz Ali, great brother. We were supposed to go, we were talking to the University of Hebron. We were going to go to Jordan and cross the King Hussein crossing and go in and hook up the University of Hebron to cover what's going on in the West Bank. But then it was like, they're like, well, do you know what? You're going to put yourself in danger. Mm. And we were like, yeah, we know that. And as soon as they said, you might put us in danger, it's like, okay, we're not coming.
Mm.
So as soon as, and here's the thing, if you want to do something risky, you need to think about, obviously, everyone in your life around your Farah is staring at me. You have to think about everyone in your life who you're going to leave behind, but also the people. If you go to get a story and you're going to put other people at risk, it's always a no, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. But then what I did do was I wrote to the Irish Army. Now, the Irish Army have been part of UNIFIL since 1978. They've been protecting the border between
Lebanon and
Israel and Lebanon. Yeah. So I wrote to them and I said, I want to do, like, 24 hours on the blue line of withdrawal, which is what it's called, on the border, to get your, and we like the Irish, they're kind of pro-Palestine, and that works for me, and they've kind of, military is military, part of the establishment, wherever you go, but they're sympathetic.
Mm.
So I thought, let's tell their story, and then at the same time, once I've told their story, I can maybe go to Tyre and talk to some refugees as well. So we were lined up to go. Four broadcasters. We were fifth in line. So it was CNN, Sky, BBC, and then RTE. They said, after RTE, the Irish broadcaster, you can go. Between that, Israel bombs a UNIFIL car.
Hmm.
And that was it. They said, you're not going. We can't take you. So my mind was like, how can I get there? How can I get there? But again, it's maybe back in 2016 when I first started this journey. There was, of course, there's an element of adventure. There's an element of, probably is an element of ego. Nafs, we call it in Islam, but ego. And you want to do stuff. You want to have adventure. And but then you need to really check your intentions.
Mm.
Why are you doing this? Who's going to benefit? And if you're putting yourself at risk and other people at risk for something which is like someone on the ground could send you a video and you edit, then there's no, don't do it. And that's kind of... But yeah, I do like, maybe I'm a bit adrenaline. I do like a bit of adrenaline fueled stuff.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, yeah. Now, in terms of, we're going to go to the audience in a minute. We've got one last question, I suppose, really, Daniel. In terms of how we all feel about stories and covering things like humanitarian disasters and war zones or whatever they may be. I suppose the question I was really asking is actually, if you were looking at post what we see in Gaza, has this now, do you think it's affected how you can tell stories going forward? Do you think there's a different difference to the audience, or do you simply is it business as usual, or is there going to be some other way of telling stories because there's a new audience, or people have become desensitized, sadly, to seeing suffering?
It's my impression that there's a much wider audience for Gaza now than there was before the 7th of October. I mean, we've been covering Gaza since we started in 2014.
Yeah.
And I've never had friends that aren't working on the Middle East want to talk about something so much. So I think there's a much wider audience. Are they desensitized at this point, given the videos we've seen on social media? I'm sure. I mean, I feel a bit desensitized. Mm. But I do think that there's much more capacity now and much more potential to tell the story once there's a time for rebuilding. It's hard to imagine that now. We're still very much in the bad part of things, I think. But I do think there's going to be a lot more people that are paying attention. And
does that mean there's more opportunity then to tell stories?
Yeah.
In areas where previously, people may not necessarily have seeked them out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think so. Because, I mean, look at Parliament. Gaza comes up all the time now in Parliament. It wasn't so before the 7th of October. There are a lot of people that are really paying attention closely, I think. And so there's all kinds of angles to be covered now that I don't think there would have been beforehand, that people that haven't always looked at the Middle East will be looking for.
Okay. Well, look, we've got about 10, 15 minutes for questions. If you've got a question, please raise your hand and some Libby will come round with a microphone. So any questions? That man just next to you there.
You obviously make your own films. You probably have other filmmakers that you can call on to come in to make films too. Do you ever use indigenous people because now everybody can make a film or provide photos and, you know, if they've got a phone, you know, everybody's a filmmaker. Yeah, my question is really about, you know, do you rely or use that resource? Because we're going back to the storytelling thing you were just mentioning. When you have seen those videos that somebody's done on their phone from Gaza, some terrible atrocity, or, you know, I don't think you ever get bored or numb by that. It's searing.
By choice. If I could, I mean, there's somebody reached out to me on LinkedIn, a sister who's a journalist who lives in Gaza. And she said, I've got these ideas to make these films. And I said, okay, that's great. I said, but you'll need to be paid. And how will we pay you? So this is something that she's now trying to sort out. How can I send money to Gaza? Is it still, if I send money to Gaza now, am I going to get arrested for funding terrorism? Do you know what I mean? Because this is what this is the laws. You have to be so careful. That's one example. Most of my filmmaking up till now has been me being engaged by charities going out into the field. So my book is about my experiences of someone who has been hired by charities. I've worked alongside many local filmmakers who I'm friends with, who I promote their work. But for me, as far as my company Migration Films are concerned, I'm really small. And everything I do, unless it's tied to the back of another charity, is self-funded right now. So if I manage to secure budgets, I would without a doubt work with indigenous filmmakers. I would let them operate and I would direct. In terms of remote filming, yeah, I'm open to that, of course. Absolutely. I think it's important for people from their own countries to tell the story, to honor the stories by them telling them. Yeah.
And that's exactly what you guys do, right, Danny?
Yeah, exactly. But you bring up a good point about payment.
Payment. Yeah. You can't expect people to do it for nothing. People need to be paid.
Yeah.
Especially in Gaza. They're going to put their neck on the line. They need to have something back.
Yeah. No, in Yemen, we struggled for a long time to get payments to Yemeni journalists. That really hampered our work. But yeah, no, indigenous filmmakers for sure is our thing.
Hi. I was just wondering, how do you take care of your own well-being when documenting disaster?
Very, very good question. Well, I started... how long ago did I start my therapy? A year, was it? No. Was it? Oh, blimey. It's gone so quickly. I've started doing therapy. With the Rohingya chapter 8, that's the first time I've told that story publicly and not broken down crying, actually. I think that's through the therapy that I'm doing. But I wrote a poem. That was the only way. That was the way I found it really helped. So, and you know, it's very easy to for me to sit here and go, just compartmentalize. I spoke to a friend of mine, Steve Maud from Cloud9 Films, and he does a lot of stuff for Comet Relief and films a lot in southern Africa. Meets a lot of kids, a lot of heartbreaking stories. And I said to him, how do you do it? And he said, well, what you have to remember is their story is their story, your story is your story. And you're just intersecting at that moment in time. You're the mouthpiece to the world for them. And that's it. And you disconnect and move on. And yeah, that's what one should do. But you know, the human condition is easier said than done often, so.
I mean, you talked before, obviously, didn't you, as well, about obviously the kind of like the duty of care to people, and So I did that. I did the thing with a film and TV charity, which I don't know if any of you guys actually bothered to fill in, which was a survey of Muslims, Jewish and Arabs working in film and TV and mental health. And about 95% of people working in the film and TV industry from those three backgrounds had found that their mental health had been detrimentally affected by what had happened in Gaza and October the 7th. So there is a need for kind of like some kind of counselling or whatever. And then there was that thing I was telling you about before, you know, with Don McCullin, the famous war photographer, and once asked him, you know, why did you really stop being a war photographer? And he said, well, I see their faces at night, Akhil, still, you know, and he's talking about, he stopped doing it in the mid-80s. So it's real, yeah. Any more questions?
So, sorry, was that with Daniel, what about you?
No. She,
it's a real thing. I mean, and we've talked about this in our London office. It's funny, when I said earlier I felt overwhelmed, I felt embarrassed later in my head. I thought, I don't have a right to be overwhelmed. How did I tell them that? And then I thought, no, wait.
Of course you are.
Everyone in our London office feels very overwhelmed and very upset by what's happened. And we've actually had, we had some sort of professionals come in and have a chat with us. And we didn't really get many solutions. It was sort of like, have hobbies, go for runs, you know, it's sort of that kind of stuff. But I guess it's just to say, I think one of the hardest parts is that you feel like you can close your laptop at the end of the day or go have dinner with your kid or whatever, and that feels very wrong when you can see what's going on. I think there's something also about the 24/7 news cycle.
Yeah.
You can feel like, oh, I can't stop working because they can't stop being bombed, so I don't get to stop working, and it's very unhealthy after a while, and you can't do your job after a while if you keep up like that. So I don't know if I have an answer, really, but I do know, like, this is the first time, covering this war is the first time I've cried in an interview with somebody I was interviewing. It was just, it's a wonderful woman with this charity called Children Not Numbers. She gets children out of Gaza, gets them medically evacuated, and she was just telling me story after story after story. And she even said, I haven't had a moment to stop and process what I am doing, and I think I'm going to be permanently traumatized by this. And just by the way she was spilling out the stories, I feel like I've picked up this vicarious trauma for, you know, so anyway, I don't have a solution, I don't really know, but it's just very real, and it's happening.
Well, check out a film and TV charity, because then you can get counselling. That was the point I was trying to make. Yeah, there's that, sorry, and then there's a lady over there as well, Olivia.
Thank you for this awesome panel and sharing your experiences. My question was about the cycle of sharing information and then action that we're looking for. So the documentaries that you do and the reporting that you do, and then us facing, including yourselves, this feeling of a stalemate that nothing is changing in the public government perceptions. So given your deep experiences, all three of you, is there something that could catalyze people in power looking at what you're reporting and making a difference? Is there something missing, both either in technology or in the way the public reacts to your reporting? Thank you.
You want to kick off that, Danny?
That's such a good question. I mean, it's a question I have myself. It can be really depressing when you put out something that you think, God, everyone needs to know this. For example, I think everyone should know that, unlike the United States or Italy or Malta or several other countries, the UK is not letting Palestinian children come in for medical treatment. We're ready to offer it. There's money, you know, and that's not happening. And that feels like that story should be everywhere, and everyone should know that. And so when you put a story out like that, and you sort of see it get around, but you don't see it make any change, you're like, what am I doing wrong? Did I not do the tweet correctly? Should I be on Instagram, even though I don't really want to be on Instagram? You know, it's that kind of thing. So I don't know if I have an answer to your question, but it's one that I think we should keep working on and find a solution to. Some of it, I think, is I need to be connecting more with politicians and actually putting my stuff in front of them and asking them the questions. And I'm trying. I tried to go to Parliament and get in, and I tried to get a parliamentary pass. I couldn't get one because I'm not a big guy, but I'm not a big from a big outlet, not a big guy. I think a lot of it is FaceTime with people in power, and we need to get more of that, I think.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, I confronted David Lammy, asking him why I didn't vote for a ceasefire. And he gaslit me. He weaponized something I said to him, all in the space of like a 2-minute conversation. So I filmed him, and he still didn't answer me why. So coming face to face with him, he had his reasons, and he was 70,000 pounds of those reasons came from Gary Lubner, which we know, but anyway. But I think that boycott is a huge, huge thing. And I think that if you can, whatever you're making, if there's, like, for example, with the children not being given access, we investigate who is responsible. We look into them, we dig as deep as we can, and we push the narrative as far as we can. I don't know how a boycott would work with that in particular, but we've seen how it's worked with the Hey and Why Festival, with the Latitude Festival, you know, with Barclays, for example, people refusing to engage, pulling out because of these sponsors. So, yeah, I don't know. I hope that kind of answers it.
Oh, hi there. My name's Debbie.
Debbie.
I work with a global coalition of activists and researchers and human rights lawyers. And one of the things that we research is the impact of exposure to violence. And I think if you're empathic, and that empathy comes from wanting to make changes, one can be vulnerable because of the exposure to violence. And we've identified a number of potential risks that can happen. So there can be like a progressive erosion of empathy. It's like a defense, you know, that kind of comes in because the pain can be too much to bear. There can be a prolonged grief response where one kind of feels like acute loss and pain all the time, and or like a state of cognitive kind of dissonance, really, and people sort of manage that in different ways through anaesthetizing the pain through kind of drinking or kind of different things. So there was a question about if you're kind of aware of that and noticed any of those things in yourself. But also going back to what you were saying, Dania, about raising awareness of people in positions of power. So I did get into Parliament in October and had an audience of about 90 people just to talk about, you know, not about what happens in terms of exposure to violence, that was important, but the importance of preventing violence as well for all our psychological, emotional, physical well-being. There's really no place for it.
October the 6th, I was about 9,800 kilos. Come back from K2 base camp, was in really good fit condition. I'm now 115 kilos. I stress eat with chocolate. I stress eat, yeah. And so I actually had a black shirt on today, and I sat and I looked down and it opened up. You could just see my white belly, and I just thought, so I just want to switch it out for a T-shirt. But yeah. Humanity over everything.
Well,
but that's how I've been coping.
So anyway, look, I just want to say thank you very much for attending what is, for me, I think the last event I'll be chairing at the festival. I think it finishes today. I just want to thank Dania and Matt for a fantastic conversation, and thank you as well. And I hope you come next year, right? The last weekend of June, the first weekend of July, every year. Please get in touch with the festival. Let them know how great this all was. And all I can say to you is, big round of applause. You've been fantastic. They've been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.